Bradley. I liked the guy. Man's man and all that. And I think we could have been pals under other circumstances. Maybe if this whole thing was a misunderstanding, and Harry was found in a motel or something, Mr. Maddox would invite me up for a weekend with the boys. Maybe not. Kate said to him, "You're correct that you have no legal obligation to reveal the names of your guests, at least at this point in time. But we'd like your voluntary cooperation now, while a man's life may be in danger." Mr. Maddox considered that. "I'll need to contact my attorney." Kate reminded him, "You don't like attorneys." He smiled tightly and replied, "I don't, but neither do I like my proctologist." He continued, "I'll contact the men who were here and see if they'll agree to have their names released." "Please do that quickly. And while you're at it, I need the names and contact information of your staff." She added, "Call me tonight. Mr. Corey and I are staying at the Point." His eyebrows rose. "Are you having trouble spending the anti-terrorist budget?" "Good one. I really like this guy." I said, "We're sharing a room to save taxpayer money." He raised his eyebrows again and said, "I won't touch that one." He looked at his watch a third time and said, "Well, if I'm going to make some calls." "By the way," I said, "I noticed that we had good cell phone reception here, and I saw that tower on the hill. Is that a cell phone tower?"
"It is."
"You must have some pull."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning the population of this area is probably less than the population of Central Park on a Sunday, and I don't think a lot of these people have cell phones. Yet you have a big, expensive tower right on your property."
"You'd be surprised how many rural people own cell phones," Maddox said. "Actually, I had that built."
"For yourself?"
"For anyone who has a cell phone. My neighbors appreciate it."
"I didn't see any neighbors."
"What's your point?"
"Well, the point is, Agent Mueller had a cell phone, made and received some calls from this area, and now he's not calling or receiving. This is why we're concerned that he may be injured or worse."
Mr. Maddox replied, "Sometimes, because of the distance to surrounding relay towers, service is lost. Sometimes people lose or damage their phones. Sometimes a particular phone company has bad service in an area. Sometimes the cell phone is faulty. And sometimes the battery goes dead. I don't make too much of a non-responsive cell phone. If I did, I'd think my children were kidnapped by Martians."
I smiled. "Right. We're not making too much of it."
"Good."
He uncrossed his legs and leaned forward.
"Anything further?"
"Yeah. What kind of scotch is this?"
"Private label. Single malt. Would you like a bottle on your way out?"
"That's very generous of you, but I can't accept the gift. I can, however, drink a bottle here and not commit an ethics code violation."
"Would you like one for the road?"
I answered, "With these roads, I think I'd have trouble finding the Point sober." I suggested, "Ms. Mayfield and I would like to join your security people in the search. Then maybe we could stay here tonight. Is that possible?"
"No. It's against club regulations. Also, the house staff are all leaving for a well-deserved rest after the 3-day weekend.
I don't need much staff, and Ms. Mayfield and I can share a room."
He surprised me by saying, "You're funny. Sorry, I can't extend you an overnight invitation. But if you'd like to stay in a local motel, I'll have one of my staff lead you to South Colton. You may have already been there on your way here."
"Yeah, I think so." I guessed that the scotch had loosened him up a bit, which was why he found me amusing. So I said to him, "I don't want to keep you from making all those calls, but if you've got a minute, I'm curious about this club."
He didn't respond.
"Nothing to do with this disappearance, but this is a really great-looking place. How did it get started? What do you do here? Hunt? Fish?"
Bain Maddox lit another cigarette, sat back, and crossed his legs again.
"Well," he said, "first, the name."
In 1968, I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the United States Army and stationed at Fort Benning, Georgia, prior to shipping out to Vietnam. There were a number of officer club annexes at Benning, smaller satellite clubs where junior officers could get together, away from the brass at the main club. Great idea. I was a cop before joining the ATTF, and I can tell you, I never went to the same bars where the brass hung out. Precisely. Well, there was this one club, located in the woods at a place called Custer Hill, and called the Custer Hill Officers Club. The building was a bit basic and resembled a lodge.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yes. So, several nights a week, a few dozen young officers would get together to drink beer and eat bad pizza, and discuss life, the war, women, and, now and then, politics. Mr. Maddox seemed to leave the room and go back to that place and time. It was quiet except for the crackling fire, which was dying. He came back and continued, "It was a very bad time for the country and the army. Discipline had gone to hell. The nation was badly divided. There were riots in the cities, assassinations, bad news from the front, and classmates, people we knew, were dying in Vietnam, or coming home terribly wounded, physically, mentally, and spiritually. And this is what we talked about." He finished his scotch and lit yet another cigarette, saying, "We felt betrayed. We felt that our sacrifices, our patriotism, our service, and our beliefs had become irrelevant and detested by much of the country." He looked at us and said, "This is nothing new in the history of the world, but it was something new for America." Neither Kate nor I commented. Bain Maddox continued, "Well, we became bitter, then radical, I suppose you'd say, and we took a vow that if we lived, we'd dedicate our lives to righting many wrongs." I didn't think that was the exact nature of the vow. The word revenge came to mind. Maddox went on, "So most of us shipped out, some of us returned, and we stayed in touch. Some of us, like myself, stayed in the army, but most got out when their obligation was completed. Many of us became successful, and we often helped those who didn't, or who needed a career boost or a job referral. A classic old boys network, but this one was born in the cauldron of turbulent times, hardened by blood and war, and tested by years of wandering through the wilderness that America had become. And then, as we grew older and more successful, and as our influence grew, and as America began to regain her strength and find her way again, we saw that we counted." Again he fell silent and glanced around, as though he were thinking about how he'd gotten here in this big lodge, so far from the small officers' club in the woods of Georgia. He said, "I built this lodge as a gathering place about 20 years ago. I said, "So you guys didn't come up here just for the hunting and fishing? I mean, there's a business angle here, and maybe a little political stuff, too." He considered his response. "We were engaged in the war against communism, and I can say truthfully and with some pride that many members of this club were instrumental in the final victory over that sick ideology and the ending of the Cold War." He regarded us and said, "And now? Well, we have a new enemy. There will always be a new enemy." "And," I asked, "are you involved?" "Not to the extent we were involved in the Cold War. We're all older now. We fought the good fight, and we deserve a peaceful retirement." He looked at Kate and me and said, "It's up to people your age to fight this one." I asked him, "So the members of this club are all Army veterans from the original Custer Hill Club?" "No, not really. Some of us have passed on, and some have dropped out. We've added new members over the years, men who share our beliefs and who lived through those times. We've made them honorary members of the original Custer Hill Officers Club, Fort Benning, Georgia, 1968.
I thought about that, and about rich men, and powerful men meeting on a long weekend in a remote lodge, and I thought that maybe there was nothing to this, and maybe the Justice Department was going through one of its many moments of paranoia. On the other hand, I said to him, "Well, thank you for sharing that with us. It's really interesting, and maybe you should all write your memoirs."
He smiled and said, "We'd all go to jail."
"Excuse me?"
"For some of our Cold War activities. We pushed it a bit."
"Yeah?
But all's well that ends well. Don't you agree that to fight monsters, you must sometimes become a monster?"
I replied, "No, I don't."
Kate seconded that. "We need to fight the good fight in a good way. That's what makes us different from them."
"Well," replied Bane Maddox, "when someone is aiming a nuclear missile at you, you're perfectly justified in kicking them in the balls."
I could see his point, but arguments like this could go on for days and nights, and I think he'd already had these arguments and resolved these questions many years ago over beer and pizza. I'd always thought that people of that generation who came of age in the 60s were somehow different, and maybe scarred, and maybe still carrying one grudge or another. But I don't get paid to think about things like this, or to offer free counseling. Nevertheless, I said to Mr. Maddox, "So you do have comrades who would come looking for you if you disappeared." He looked at, or through me, for a while, then said, "Do I?" "I did. When I was young and wore the uniform, I think they're all gone now. Except for Carl. He served under me in Vietnam." He added, "Carl and Kaiser Wilhelm are loyal." "Well, if there was a sled named Rosebud lying around, I would have thrown it in the fireplace and faded to black. Instead, I stood and said, "Thank you for your time." Kate, too, stood and picked up a briefcase. He seemed almost surprised that he was getting rid of us, and for a moment, I thought he looked disappointed. He asked us, "Are you going to join my staff in the search?" I didn't think that Kate and I would accomplish anything by riding around these 16,000 acres with Maddox's security staff until nightfall.
"Mr. Corey?"
On the other hand, I wouldn't have minded taking a look around the property. But Kate and I weren't even supposed to be here, and we were already late for our meeting with Major Schaefer at State Police Headquarters. I glanced at Kate, then answered, "We'll leave it to your staff to conduct the search. But we'll be back in the morning with search parties." He nodded and said, "Fine. I'll have my staff begin the search immediately. I'll also make sure tomorrow's search party has terrain maps and the use of my vehicles and staff." Kate asked, "Didn't you say your staff is going on holiday?"
"The house staff is off. The security staff will be here."
"May I ask why you have so many security people here?"
Maddox replied, "It's really not that many if you consider they work in shifts to cover a 7-day week, 24 hours a day, every day of the year."
"But why do you need that kind of security?"
He answered, "A house like this attracts unwanted attention. Besides, the local police are stretched thin and the state police are some distance away. I rely on my own security." She didn't pursue that, and Bane Maddox said, "I'll show you out." We walked toward the door, and on the way I asked him, "Will you be here tomorrow?"
"I may be."
He paused. "My plans are up in the air." And so were his two jets. I asked him, "Where do you live full time?"
"New York City."
"Any other homes?"
"A few."
"How do you get out of here? Car? Plane?" He replied, "Usually someone drives me to the regional airport in Saranac Lake. Why do you ask?"
"I just want to be sure we can reach you tomorrow. Do you have a cell phone?"
"I don't give that number out, but if you'll call the security guard number here,
Someone is on 24 hours a day, and they'll locate me. If we discover anything, we'll call you at the point. He gave me the security number. But I'll probably see you in the morning.
You will. Do you have a private plane?
He hesitated, then replied, I do. Why do you ask?
Can you be reached on the plane?
Usually.
Why? Are you planning any flights in or out of the country?
I go when and where business takes me. I'm not sure why you need to know this.
I just need to know that I can contact you if there's any misunderstandings or problems with your security people, who seem very protective and not particularly easy to deal with.
That's what they get paid for. But I'll make sure they understand that you and Ms. Mayfield can reach me, and that the search teams can traverse the property freely in the morning.
Great. That's all we need.
We passed through the library into the lobby, and I said, So, you built this place?
Yes, in 1982.
He added, As a kid, I always admired the grand lodges up here, and also what were called the Great Camps, built by millionaires at the turn of the last century. In fact, the point where you're staying was a Rockefeller Great Camp.
Yeah, I know. You have a tux I can borrow?
He smiled. I'd opt for room service.
Me too.
So why didn't you buy one of these old places, which are probably for sale all over? He thought a moment, then replied, Well, I looked at a few, but this private parcel was available in the park, and I bought it for $300,000, less than $20 an acre. Best investment I ever made.
Better than oil?
We made eye contact, and he said, I suppose you know who I am.
Well, you're not exactly unknown.
I try to keep a low profile, but that's not always possible. Thus, the security here.
Right. Good idea. Nobody's gonna get you here.
I don't think anyone is actually after me.
You never know.
He ignored that, and I asked him, Hey, what's with the price of oil? Up or down?
Your guess is as good as mine.
That's pretty scary.
He smiled and replied, Bet on $50 a barrel as we get closer to the war in Iraq.
He added, You didn't hear that from me.
Gotcha.
He seemed to want to talk, which was fine with me, and he drew our attention to a wall where about 24 bronze plaques were mounted, each bearing a name and a date. He said, These are some of the men I served with, and their dates of death. The earlier dates are those who died in Vietnam. The later ones died in one war or another since then, and some died natural deaths. He moved closer to the plaques and said, I built this place partly as a memorial to them, partly as a reminder of our beginnings at the Custer Hill Officers Club, and partly as a place to gather on Veterans Day and Memorial Day for those of us still around. After a few seconds of silence, Kate said, That's very nice.
Bane Maddox continued to stare at the names, then turned to us.
Also, when I built this place, it was the height of the Cold War, and you might remember that the news media was trying to whip the country into a state of hysteria about Reagan leading us to nuclear Armageddon.
I said, Yeah, I remember that. They had me going for a while. I was buying canned chili and beer by the case.
Maddox smiled politely and continued, Well, I never thought we were going to have a nuclear exchange. Not with mutually assured destruction, but the idiots in the media and Hollywood had us all dead and buried.
He added, Basically, they're a bunch of old ladies.
That's an insult to old ladies. He went on, Anyway, I suppose that was on my mind when I decided to build this place. I know it was on my wife's mind.
You're married?
Not anymore.
Is she a Democrat or something?
She's a card-carrying consumer.
So, I asked, you have a fallout shelter here?
I do. A totally useless expense, but that's what she wanted.
Well, I said, fallout is tricky stuff.
Fallout is overrated.
I'd never heard radioactive fallout described in quite that way, and for a moment I thought I was speaking to Dr. Strangelove. Maddox glanced at a Black Forest cuckoo clock on the wall and said to us, I'd show you around, but I'm sure you have other stops to make. I reminded him, we'll be back tomorrow at first light. He nodded and moved toward the door. I said, great painting of the little bighorn. Thank you. It's very old, artist unknown, and I don't think it's an accurate representation of the final moments of that battle. Who would know? They all died. The Indians didn't all die. I wanted to tell him my joke, but I could feel Kate's eyes on me. Well, they were foolhardy, but brave. More foolhardy than brave, I'm afraid. He added, I was in the 7th Cavalry, Custer's regiment. You don't look that old, or... I nodded toward the painting. In Vietnam, Mr. Corey, the regiment still exists. Oh, right. He stood by the door, and there was a moment of almost awkward silence. This is where I usually spring something on the suspect, leaving him or her to a bad night's sleep. But in truth, I had no more arrows in my quiver, to use an apt metaphor, and I was really unsure if Bane Maddox had anything to do with Harry's disappearance, so I said to him, thank you for your time and help. I'll send my men out immediately, he replied. Meanwhile, if the air search comes up with anything, have the state police call that security guard number, and I'll get some people on the ground where the helicopters have lit up the area. If we're lucky, we may find this man tonight. I think some prayers might help, too. Maddox commented, as long as it's above freezing, a person can survive in the woods for weeks if he's not badly hurt. He opened the door, and we all went out onto the veranda. I noticed that the Enterprise rental car that had been there was gone. I said to him, I want to thank you for your service to our country. He nodded. Kate said, yes, thank you. Maddox replied, and you're both serving in a different way, in a different war. I thank you for that. This may be the toughest fight we've ever had. Stay with it. We will prevail. We will, Kate said. We will, agreed Mr. Maddox, and added, I hope I live long enough to see a permanent condition green. Chapter 23 We got into our Taurus and followed the black jeep downhill toward the gate. We didn't speak while we were inside the property in case there were directional listening devices, but we did turn on our cell phones and beepers, which indicated that Kate had 2 messages and I had none. The dashboard clock said it was 4:58 p.m., so Tom Walsh should still be in his office defending Western civilization for another 2 minutes. At the guardhouse, the jeep pulled to the side and the gate slid open. As we exited the property, I could see 2 guards through a window of the house, and one of them was videotaping us. I leaned toward Kate's window and saluted with my middle finger. McEwen Pond Road lay in shadow, and I turned on my headlights so I could spot the bears sooner. I asked Kate, well, what are your thoughts? She stayed silent a while, then replied, he's charming in a spooky sort of way. One of the more interesting things in life is hearing a woman's thoughts on a man you've both met. Men that I find ugly, she finds good-looking. Men I find slimy, she finds sociable, and so forth. In this case, however, I sort of agreed with Kate. She said, I think he liked you. She added, don't take this wrong, but he sort of reminded me of you. How's that, darling? Well, the self-confidence and the, for want of a better expression, the male macho bullshit. Good expression. More important, does he know more about Harry than he's telling us? I don't know. His whole demeanor seemed almost nonchalant. I replied, the sign of a sociopath and narcissist. Yes, but sometimes the sign of a person who has nothing to hide. He has something to hide, even if it's only oil price rigging. That's why the Justice Department is interested in him.
True, but...
And yet, I said, he invites us in without his lawyer present.
What's your point?
He wants to know what we know, and he can learn that by the questions we ask him.
That's one way to look at it.
And how about that story of the Custer Hill Club? She nodded.
What a story. It's really amazing if you think about it. I mean, these young officers, staying in touch, some of them getting rich and powerful, and Bane Maddox building that lodge.
Yeah. What's more amazing is that he actually admitted to us that this group is or was some sort of secret society that somehow influenced events on the world stage during the Cold War, including engaging in illegal activities. She thought a moment, then replied,
"He wants to sound important and powerful. Guys do that. But if any of that is true, then it puts a whole different light on the Custer Hill Club."
She pointed out, "He raised some suspicions he didn't need to raise. He may have thought we already knew about the history of the club."
"Or," Kate said, "it's past history and he's proud of it, like he's proud of his Vietnam service. I don't know.
But then he said he was a little involved with the war on terrorism."
"Right. That's like being a little pregnant."
I said, "As I suspected, there's more to this group than meets the eye. There's a political element here, and in today's world, Mr. Maddox's oil mixes well with politics."
"It always did."
I changed the subject back to our immediate concern. "So, did Maddox have anything to do with Harry's disappearance?" She stayed quiet, then said,
"The one thing that bothered me was his stalling, like he was waiting for Harry to turn up."
I nodded and said, "That would take the heat off him." I added, "I have this bad feeling that Harry is going to turn up soon, and not on Bane Maddox's property."
Kate nodded silently, then said, "I need to check my phone messages."
She listened to them and said to me,
"Tom, twice. He says I need to call him ASAP.
I wondered why Walsh had called her and not me, too. She checked her beeper and said,
"Tom, twice."
He's a persistent little shit, isn't he?
He's not. What is your problem with authority?
My problem is with supervisors who bullshit me and expect loyalty in return. The essence of loyalty is reciprocity. If you're loyal to me, I'll be loyal to you. Bullshit me, and I'll bullshit you. That's the contract.
Thank you for sharing that.
Now, I'll call our supervisor while you give your undivided attention to the road. Drive slowly so we don't run out of cell phone coverage. I eased up on the gas and said, "Put it on speakerphone." She dialed, and Walsh's voice came through her phone. "Where the hell have you been?" he asked. Kate replied, without bullshit,
"We interviewed Bane Maddox at the Custer Hill Club."
"What? I specifically told you... Was this your idiot husband's idea?" I cut in. "Hi, Tom. Idiot husband here." Silence, followed by,
"Corey, you have really screwed up this time."
"That's what you said last time." He was not a happy man and almost shouted, "You totally disobeyed my orders. Your history, mister." Kate seemed a little ruffled and said,
"Tom, we've gotten permission from Maddox to conduct a search on his land at first light. Meanwhile, he promised to begin a search with his security staff immediately."
No reply, and I thought the call was dropped or Tom was having a seizure or something. I said to Kate, "Do you want some of these Cheez-Its?" Kate asked,
"Tom, are you there?"
His voice came through the phone, and he said, "I'm afraid we don't need to continue the search." Neither of us responded, and I felt my stomach tighten. I already knew what he was going to say, but I didn't want to hear it. Tom Walsh informed us, "The state police have found the body of a man that they've tentatively identified by the contents of his wallet and photo ID as that of Harry Muller." Again, neither of us said anything. Then Tom Walsh said, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news. I pulled off to the side of the road, took a deep breath, and asked Walsh, "What are the details?" "Well, about 3:15 this afternoon, the State Police Regional Headquarters in Raybrook, where you are supposed to be, got an anonymous call from a man who said he was hiking in the woods and saw a body lying on a trail. He said he approached the body, determined that the man was dead, apparently from a gunshot wound, then ran back to his vehicle, drove to a park emergency phone, and called the police. He added, the man would not give his name." I thought about that, and I thought I knew the man's name. I was an expert rifleman in the army. Walsh went on, "This man gave a fairly accurate description of the location, and within half an hour, the state and local police, using search dogs, found the body. A further search discovered Harry's camper about 3 miles south of where the body was found, so it appears that Harry was heading toward the Custer Hill Club, about 3 miles further north of the trail." I said, "That doesn't comport with Harry's phone call to his girlfriend." "Well, I played that message again, and Harry said, quote, 'I'm on duty, near the right-wing Looney Lodge.'" Walsh said, "You can't take that to mean he was within sight of or very near the Custer Hill property." This man was obviously not a detective. "Tom," I said, "it doesn't make sense that he'd park his camper 6 miles away, then call his girlfriend at 7:48 a.m., then begin hoofing it through the woods. It would take him almost 2 hours just to get to the fence, and I assume he was supposed to be at or near Custer Hill at first light. But if we believe this scenario, then he wouldn't have arrived until almost 10 a.m. You following me on this, Tom?" He didn't respond for a few seconds, then said, "Yes, but good. And while you're at it, get a triangulation on Harry's cell phone call to his girlfriend. That will tell you where he was when he called." "Thank you. I know that. The phone company is working on it. But other than the cell tower at the Custer Hill Club, there may not be any other towers close enough to get a triangulation." "How did you know about that cell tower on the Custer Hill property?" There were a few seconds of silence. Then he said, "I just got that from the phone company. We should know more in an hour or so. But I have to tell you, even if he was near the Custer Hill property when he called his girlfriend, it doesn't mean he entered the property. He may have gotten spooked by something and was headed back toward his camper when he was shot. You know, there's always two or more ways to look at evidence." "Really? I'll have to remember that. And by the way, sometimes a little common sense goes a long way. Federal prosecutors don't care about common sense. They want the evidence to speak for itself. This evidence does not." "Well, then, we need more evidence. Tell me about the gunshot wound," I said. "The shot entered his upper torso from the rear, and I'm told it probably severed his spinal column and exited through his heart. No bullet recovered yet. Death was probably instantaneous. I spoke to Major Schaefer, and he assures me there was no indication that Harry lingered. He apparently died where he fell." He added, "There was cash in his wallet, and he had his watch, gun, credentials, video camera, digital camera, and so forth. So according to the state police, it appears to have been a hunting accident." "I can still drop a deer at 200 yards. I replied, "That's what it's supposed to look like." Walsh didn't comment. I said, "Obviously we need to look at what's on his cameras." "Already done. There's nothing on the videotape or the digital disc." I said, "Get the tape and discs to our lab and see if anything was erased." "That's being done." Kate asked him, "How soon can we get an autopsy report?"
The body is being transported to the county morgue in Potsdam for a positive identification using photo and fingerprints on file from FBI headquarters. I have instructed that the autopsy not be done there. This is too important to leave to a local medical examiner. I'm having the body flown here to Bellevue tonight or tomorrow. Good move. Fax me a copy of the autopsy and toxicology report. Toxicology could take 4 to 6 days. 2 or 3 on an expedited basis. Also, get word to Bellevue to look for signs of foul play. Drugging, bruises, signs of rope or handcuff marks on the skin, and trauma other than the gunshot wound. Also, the time of death is very important. You may find this difficult to believe, but the New York City Medical Examiner, the state police, and the FBI do this for a living. I ignored that and continued, also, have a state police investigator at the morgue ASAP to witness the removal of the clothing and personal effects. He or she needs to look for signs that the clothing or personal effects were tampered with in any way. There's someone from the State Bureau of Investigation on their way to the morgue. Plus, we have 2 agents coming from Albany. We're going to get involved with this investigation because it was a federal agent on assignment who was killed. Good. And also make sure the state police and the FBI do a complete crime scene investigation and look for witnesses. You need to assume a homicide was committed. I understand, but it could also be what it appears to be, an accident. This happens all the time up there. Meanwhile, if you were where you were supposed to be, you'd be where you need to be to give your expert advice on how to conduct this autopsy and investigation. Tom, fuck you. I know you're upset, so I'll ignore that. Once. Fuck you. He ignored it a second time and asked, "Where are you now?" Kate replied, "We've just left the Custer Hill Club." Walsh said, "Well, not only did you waste your time there, but you also tipped off Bane Maddox that he was under surveillance." Kate came to my defense. "John handled it very well. If Maddox didn't know he was under surveillance, he still doesn't know. If he already knew, then it's a moot point." Walsh said, "The real point is you weren't supposed to be there under any circumstances. What good did you do by going there, John?" I replied, "I was on a mission of mercy, Tom. I got what I wanted, permission to conduct a search. Okay, we don't need a search anymore, though I'm ready to do it anyway just to mess with Bane Maddox." "That's not going to happen. Now that you've paid him a visit, we are obligated by law to inform him that the person in question has been found off his property. Don't be too quick with that information." "John, I'm not messing around with this timeline. This guy is not your average Joe citizen. He'll be brought up to date by a phone call by a state or local law enforcement officer within the hour." "Let me discuss that with Major Schaefer first." "Why?" I said, "I just spent 40 minutes with Maddox, and I got some strange vibes from him. I think that son of a bitch had Harry at his place, grilled him, then murdered him." That's quite a statement. Think about what you're saying. You think about it." Walsh said, "Kate?" She took a deep breath and said, "It's possible. I mean, it is possible." "What would be Maddox's motive?" Walsh inquired. I replied, "I don't know, but I will find out." He stayed silent for a few seconds, then said, "All right. We'll certainly proceed as though it were a homicide. Meanwhile, I need to call Harry's girlfriend, Lori, and Washington is on the other line, so send someone, a cop from the task force, to see Lori Bonick in person and have a police chaplain along. Also, Harry has kids and an ex-wife. You need to send someone whom the family knows to do the notifications, like his old squad commander or his former partner. Speak to Vince Parisi. He'll know how to take care of it." "I understand. Meanwhile, drive now to the airport and wait for a helicopter to pick you up. A state trooper will meet you there with Harry's cameras, which you will bring to 26 Fed
Hold on, I said. We're not leaving here until this investigation is complete. You're coming back to Manhattan tonight. I'll be here. Tom, excuse me, you need your people on the scene.
Thank you. I know that.
In fact, two people from this office will be on that helicopter. You, Detective Corey, are off this case, and so is Kate. Return immediately. Meanwhile, headquarters is on hold, and I don't have the time or patience to...
Neither do I.
Let me give this to you straight, Tom. Number one, Harry Muller was my friend. Two, you wanted my ass on that assignment, and I could now be lying in that morgue instead of him. Three, I think he was murdered. And four, if you pull me off this case, I'm gonna make a stink that they'll smell in the Justice Department.
Are you threatening me with something?
Yes. Five, you sent that man into a fortified camp with no clue about what was there. Hell, I just left this place, and a Delta team couldn't penetrate it, and you either knew that or should have known it. Six, Harry Muller went in there carrying his credentials and no plausible cover story. How long have you been doing this for a living?
He was really hot and yelled, Let me tell you something.
No, let me tell you something, Einstein. You totally fucked up. But you know what? I'll go to bat for you when the shit hits the fan.
Why? Because I like you?
No. Because you are right now gonna tell me to stay here and stay on the case. If you don't, my next stop after 26 Fed will be Washington. You understand?
It took him about 4 seconds to understand, and he said, You make a compelling argument for your continued work on the case.
But so help me God, Corey, if you were doing fine until so help me God. Quit while you're even.
I will get even.
You'll be lucky if you don't get sent to Wichita. I said, I'll let you and Kate have the last word. Kate was really shaken up, and she said to Walsh,
I have to agree with John that Harry's assignment was not well thought out, and not well handled.
She added, That could have been my husband lying in the morgue.
Walsh didn't respond to that and said instead, I need to speak to headquarters.
Anything further? Kate said,
No.
He said, Get over to the state police in Raybrook and call me from there.
He hung up, and we both sat in silence for a while on the side of the road. I could hear birds in the woods and the sound of the engine idling. Finally, Kate said, I was afraid we'd get that news. I didn't reply, lost in my own thoughts about Harry Muller, who'd sat across from me for about 3 years. Two former cops, working as strangers in a strange land called 26 Federal Plaza. Body shipped back to New York City for an autopsy. Funeral home Thursday and Friday, and mass and burial on Saturday. Kate took my hand and said, I just can't believe this. For months after 9/11, I attended wakes, funerals, masses, and memorial services, day and night, sometimes 3 in a day. Everyone I knew was on this insane, soul-numbing schedule, and as the weeks went by, I'd run into the same people at funeral homes, churches, synagogues, and cemeteries. And we'd all just look at one another with eyes that were beyond expression. The shock and trauma were fresh, but the funerals started to blur into one another, and the only difference was the grief-stricken family who never looked the same as the last grief-stricken family. And then the widows and kids would show up at some other cop's funeral to pay their respects, and they became part of the crowd of mourners. It was a gut-wrenching and surreal time. Black months, with black caskets and black shrouds, and black mourning bands on shiny badges, and black mornings after a night of too much drinking. I can still remember the shrill of the bagpipe bands, the final salute, and the casket, more often than not containing not much more than a body part, being lowered into the grave. Kate said, "John, let me drive." Harry and I had gone to some of the funerals together, and I recalled that at Dom Finelli's funeral mass, out on the steps of the church, Harry had said to me, "When a cop thinks about getting killed on the job, he thinks about some dumb dirtbag who's having a lucky day. Who would have thought something like this could happen right here?" Kate asked, "John, are you all right?" I remembered, too, Dom's mother, Marion Finelli, conducting herself with great dignity, almost ignored in the crowd as everyone focused on Dom's wife and kids, and Harry said to me, "Let's go talk to her. She's alone." And that reminded me that Harry's mother was still alive, and I made a mental note to add her to the list of people who should be officially notified with a chaplain in attendance. Kate had gotten out of the car and opened my door. She took my arm and said, "I'm driving." I got out and we changed places. Kate put the car in gear, and we continued on in silence. The sky above was still light, but the road was in deep shadow, and the forest on either side was black. Now and then I could see glassy eyes shining in the dark woods, or a small animal scurrying across the road. Around a bend, a deer was trapped in our headlights, and he stood there, half petrified and half shaking in fear before bolting into the woods. Kate said, "We should be at the state police headquarters in about an hour." After 10 minutes, I said, "Harry's assignment made no sense." "John, don't think about it. He could have seen and photographed cars on this road. One way in, one way out. He didn't have to go onto the property."
"Please, don't think about it. There's nothing you can do about it now."
"That's why I have to think about it." She glanced at me and asked, "Do you really think it was Bane Maddox?" The circumstantial evidence and my instincts say yes, but I need more than that before I kill him. Chapter 24. We came to Route 56, which went south, back towards Saranac Lake and the state police headquarters in Raybrook, or north toward Potsdam and the morgue where Harry should have arrived by now. Kate started to turn for Raybrook, but I said, "Turn right. Let's go see Harry." She reminded me, "Tom said to go. You can't go too far wrong doing the opposite of what Tom Walsh says." She hesitated, then turned toward Potsdam. Within 10 minutes, we passed the brown sign that said we were leaving Adirondack State Park. A few miles later, we were in South Colton, where I saw Rudy talking to someone who was pumping his own gas. I said to Kate, "Pull in here." She turned the car into the gas station. I leaned out the window and called, "Hey, Rudy." He came over to the car and asked me, "Hey, how'd you make out there?" "The ice maker is fixed. I told Mr. Maddox what you said about getting the money up front, and he paid me cash."
You wasn't supposed to..."
"He's very pissed at you, Rudy."
"Oh, geez, you wasn't supposed to..."
"He wants to see you, tonight."
"Oh, geez."
"I need to get to the county hospital in Potsdam."
Yeah. Well, you just follow 56 north."
He gave me directions to the hospital, and I said to him, "When you see Maddox, tell him John Corey is also very good with a gun."
"Okay."
Kate pulled back onto the road, and we continued toward Potsdam. She said, "That sounded like a threat." To a guilty man, it's a threat. To an innocent man, it's an odd statement. She didn't reply. The terrain had opened up, and I could see houses and small farms now. The late afternoon sun cast long shadows over the rolling hills. Neither Kate nor I said much. There's something about the expectation of seeing a dead body that keeps the conversation subdued. I kept thinking about Harry Muller, and it was hard for me to believe he was dead. I replayed my last conversation with him, and I wondered if I'd had a bad feeling about his assignment, or if what happened since then made me think that. You never know. But I did know that whether or not I'd had this feeling of foreboding on Friday, I definitely had it now. Within 20 minutes, we drove into the pleasant college town of Potsdam, where we found the Canton Potsdam Hospital at the north end of town. We parked in the lot and entered the small red brick building through the front doors. There was an information desk in the lobby, and I identified myself and asked the info lady where the morgue was located. She directed us to the surgical unit that she said doubled as the morgue. This did not speak well for the staff surgeons, and if I had been in a better mood, I'd have made a joke about that. We turned down a few corridors and found the nurse's station at the surgical unit. There were two uniformed state troopers chatting up the nurses, and Kate and I showed our credentials. I said, "We're here to ID Harry Muller. Are you with the body?" One of the troopers replied, "Yes, sir. We accompanied the ambulance." "Anyone else here?"
"No, sir. You're the first."
"Who else are you expecting?"
"Well, some FBI guys from Albany and some guys from the State Bureau of Investigation."
We weren't going to have much time alone with the body before we had company. I asked, "Is the medical examiner here?"
"Yes, sir. She did a preliminary examination of the body and cataloged the personal effects. She's waiting for the state police and FBI."
"Okay. We'd like to see the body."
"I'll need you both to sign in."
I didn't want to sign in, so I said, "We're not here officially. The deceased was our colleague and friend. We're paying our respects."
"Oh, sorry. Sure."
He led us to a big steel door that was marked OR. The body of a homicide victim is considered a crime scene that needs to be secured, and the chain of evidence needs to be maintained. Thus, the presence of the two state troopers and the sign-in sheet, which led me to conclude that someone other than Kate and I thought this was not a hunting accident. The trooper opened the door and said,
"You first."
I replied, "We'd like to be alone to pay our respects." The trooper hesitated.
"I'm sorry. I can't do that. I need to be..."
"I understand. Can you do me a favor and ask the medical examiner to meet us here? We'll wait."
"Sure."
He disappeared around a corner, and I opened the door. We entered the makeshift morgue. The big operating room was brightly lit, and in the middle of the room was a steel table on which a body lay covered with a blue shroud. On either side of the table was a gurney. One held Harry's clothes, laid out as they would be worn. Boots, socks, thermal underwear, trousers, shirt, jacket, and knit cap. On the other gurney were Harry's personal effects, and I could see the cameras, binoculars, maps, cell phone, wallet, watch, a pair of wire cutters, and so forth. On his keychain were ignition keys for his government vehicle, a Pontiac Grand Am, and his private vehicle, a Toyota. But no key for whatever kind of camper he had been driving. I assumed that the camper key was with the state police or the CSI team so they could move his camper. His gun and credentials would be with the troopers outside. The room smelled of disinfectant, formaldehyde, and other unpleasant things, so I went over to a cabinet and found a tube of Vicks, which is a standard item in a place where cadavers are cut up. I squeezed some of the mentholated jelly on Kate's finger and said, "Smear this under your nose." She smeared it on her upper lip and took a deep breath. I don't normally use the stuff, but it had been a while since I'd been around a stiffening body, so I too put some under my nose. I found a box of latex gloves. We slipped on a pair, and I said to Kate, "Let's take a look, okay?" She nodded. I went to the table and pulled the blue sheet down from the face. Harry Muller. I said to myself, "Sorry, pal." His face was dirty because he'd fallen face first on the trail, and his lips were slightly parted, but I saw no grimace or any indication that he'd been in agony. So death had come quickly. We should all be so lucky when we're that unlucky. His eyes were wide open, so I pushed the lids closed. I pulled the sheet down to his waist and saw a big gauze pad taped over his heart. There was very little blood on his body, so the bullet had stopped the heart almost immediately. I noticed the lividity of his skin, the pooling of the blood on the front of his body, confirming he'd fallen face first and died in that position. I lifted his left arm. Rigor usually sets in within 8 to 12 hours, and there was almost no flex in his muscles, but neither was his arm totally rigid. Also, from the appearance of the skin and the general state of the body, I'd say death had occurred 12 to 24 hours ago. To take it a step further, if this was a premeditated murder, it had probably been done at night to minimize the chance of discovery during the commission of the crime. Therefore, it probably happened last night. Assuming Maddox did this, he probably waited for someone to find the body and report it to the police. When that didn't happen by this afternoon, he or an accomplice phoned it in from a park phone, thereby taking the heat off himself before the search of his property began. In fact, while Kate and I were sitting with him, he was probably wondering why his phone tip hadn't turned up the body yet, and he was getting nervous. I examined Harry's wrist and thumb and saw no evidence of restraints, though often there are no marks. I took Harry's left hand in mine and examined the palm, fingernails, and knuckles. The hands can sometimes tell you something that the coroner, who is usually more interested in organs and trauma, misses, but I saw nothing unusual, only dirt. I glanced at Kate, who seemed to be holding up okay. Then I came around the table and took Harry's right hand and looked at it. A female voice said, "Can I loan you my scalpel?" Kate and I turned to see a woman at the door dressed in surgical scrubs. She was about 30, petite, with short red hair. As she moved closer, I saw she had freckles and blue eyes. Actually, baggy blue scrubs aside, she was cute. She said, "I'm Patty Gleason, the county coroner. I assume you're the FBI people." I pulled off my latex glove and extended my hand. "Detective John Corey, Anti-Terrorist Task Force." We shook, and I introduced FBI Special Agent Kate Mayfield, remembering to add, "Kate is also Mrs. Corey." Kate further added, "I'm also Detective Corey's supervisor." Dr. Gleason suggested, "Maybe you can tell him not to handle the body without a medical examiner present. Or maybe not handle it at all." I apologized, but informed her, "I did this for 20 years in New York City." "You're not in New York City." We were off on the wrong foot, but then Kate said, "The deceased was a friend of ours." Dr. Gleason softened. "I'm sorry." She turned to Kate. "What does this have to do with terrorism?" "Nothing. Harry was also a colleague on the task force, and he was up here hiking, and we've come to identify the body."
"I see. And have you made a positive identification?"
"We have," Kate answered.
"What's your preliminary finding?"
"Well, from what I can see from the external wounds, a bullet passed through his spinal column, then through his heart, and he died almost instantly. He probably felt nothing, and if he did, it was for only a second or two. He was basically dead before he hit the ground." I nodded and observed, "In all my years as a cop, I've never seen a perfect shot through the spine and heart that was an accident." Dr. Gleason didn't comment for a few seconds, then said, "As a surgeon and coroner, I've seen about 100 hunting accident wounds, and I've never seen one quite like this either. But it can happen." She asked, "You're thinking it was homicide?" I replied, We're not ruling it out. She nodded.
That's what I hear.
Some medical examiners like to play detective, like on TV, but most stick strictly to the facts. Not knowing Patty Gleason, I asked, did you find anything that would indicate a homicide?
I'll show you what I found, and you can take it from there.
She went over to the supply cabinet, snapped on a pair of gloves, then gave me a fresh glove and said,
I see you've already found the Vicks.
She motioned toward the two gurneys.
I've removed and cataloged everything for placement into evidence bags by the FBI. Do you want to go over the inventory and sign for this stuff?
Kate replied, there are other agents on the way who need to list everything on what we call the green sheet. I said to Dr. Gleason, let's look at the body. She moved beside the gurney and pulled the taped gauze off Harry's chest, removing some hair and revealing a big, gaping hole.
As you can see, this is the exit wound. I used a lighted 7x magnifier and observed bits of bone, soft tissue, and blood, all in minute quantities and consistent with the passage of a high-velocity, large or medium-caliber bullet through the vertebrae, heart, and sternum.
She went on for a while, clinically describing the end of a human life. She concluded,
as you know, I'm not doing the autopsy, but I doubt there's much more an autopsy is going to show in regard to the cause of death.
I said to her, we're more interested in the events that led up to the moment of death. I asked, did you notice anything unusual?
As a matter of fact, I did.
She put her finger on Harry's chest, an inch from the edge of the ragged exit wound, and said,
I noticed here. Can you see that?
No.
Well, it's a small puncture wound.
Obviously made before death.
I probed it, and it's deep into the muscle tissue. I also examined his shirt and thermal top, and there seem to be corresponding holes, and what appears to be a small blood stain. So this object, possibly a hypodermic needle, was pushed hard through his clothing and into his pectoral muscle. I can't say if anything was injected, but toxicology should be able to tell us.
Dr. Gleason continued, and here are two more puncture wounds on his right forearm. No blood or corresponding holes on his clothing. Nor did I find a hypodermic needle in his possession, and I assume he wasn't medicating himself through his shirt. I asked her, what do you make of those puncture wounds?
You're the detective.
Right. I thought that the first puncture wound was the one in the chest, through his clothing, which meant it was probably a sedative, administered while he was struggling, or maybe administered from an animal tranquilizer gun. If it's off-season, we just tranquilize them and relocate them. The other two, through the bare skin, were hypodermics, given to keep him sedated. I also wondered if it was sodium pentothal, truth serum, but I kept my thoughts to myself and said, I'll think about it. She continued,
I want to show you two more things that lead me to believe there may have been some other unusual events or incidents leading up to the time of death.
We watched her move around the table toward Harry's head. Little Patty Gleason put her hands under Harry's shoulders and pushed his big torso forward into a sitting position, which caused some gas to escape. Kate drew a startled breath. Coroners, I've noticed, are not gentle with the deceased, and there's no reason why they should be, though I'm always surprised at how they handle a body. I could see the entry wound now, dead center through his spinal column and in line with his heart. I tried to picture how it happened. Harry was probably still drugged and positioned on the trail, standing or kneeling, by a person or persons while the shooter stood close enough to get a perfect shot, but not close enough for the muzzle blast to leave burns or powder fragments. Or Harry had been lying down someplace else when he was shot and then moved to the trail. But that was too amateurish, and any CSI team would see that. In any case, he'd been shot in the back,
and all I could hope for was that he didn't know it was coming.
Dr. Gleason was drawing our attention to something else.
Here, look at this.
She put her finger on Harry's right shoulder blade.
This is a discoloration on his skin, which is hard to identify. It's not a contusion or a chemical burn, and not quite a heat burn. It could be electrical.
Kate and I got closer to the faintly discolored spot, about the size and shape of a half dollar. It wasn't made by a stun gun, but I'd seen something like this made by electric cattle prod. Dr. Gleason was looking at me as I stared at the mark on Harry's shoulder. I said, "I don't know what it is."
She moved to the side of the table and unceremoniously pulled the blue sheet down to the end, exposing Harry's naked body. She started to say something, but I interrupted.
"Would you mind lowering the body?"
"Oh, sorry."
She pushed Harry's stiffening torso down on the table while I held his legs.
"I mean, I'm used to dead bodies, but they should be lying down, not sitting up."
Kate, I could see, was borderline holding it together.
Dr. Gleason made her way down the length of the gurney. Well-nourished, well-muscled, middle-aged Caucasian male. Normal skin, except as noted, and also noted is that he hadn't bathed or shaved in a few days, which is consistent with some time in the outdoors and with his soiled clothing. Nothing I see here is remarkable until we get to his feet and ankles.
The three of us stood at Harry's bare feet, and Dr. Gleason said,
"The soles of his feet are soiled, as though he'd been walking barefoot. But this is not outdoor soil or vegetation, I see."
I nodded.
She continued, "I found a few fibers that look like rug or carpet fibers. Plus, you can see what looks like fine dust or dirt that you'd find on a floor. I understand he had a camper, and you should see if he had a rug in there, and take fiber and dirt samples."
I knew another place where I should take fiber and dirt samples, but the chance of getting a search warrant for the Custer Hill Lodge was not good at this point. I moved closer to Harry and said, "There are contusions on both ankles."
"Yes, there are. Plus abrasions. These are very visible, as you can see, and the only thing I can think of was that he was wearing ankle restraints. Metal, not tape or rope or anything pliable, and that he struggled against them or tried to run in them. That's why these contusions are so pronounced and so profuse."
She added,
"The skin is broken in two places."
She noted,
"I believe his boots and socks were put on after the ankle shackles were removed. I believe he was barefoot when he had the shackles on. Look at the location of the skin abrasions and contusions."
Whatever happened to Harry in the hours before his death, it wasn't pleasant. Knowing him as I did, I was sure he wasn't a model prisoner, and thus the cattle prod, the apparent injections, and the ankle restraints.
"You did good, buddy."
Dr. Gleason said,
"After I noticed these fibers on his feet, I looked over the rest of his body and found some fibers on his hair and on his face. They could be from his knit cap, but that's dark blue, and these fibers are multicolored."
I didn't comment, but apparently Harry had been lying down on a rug or a blanket.
Dr. Gleason added, "Also, there are fibers on his trousers and shirt, and his thermal underwear, and they, too, appear to be foreign to anything he was wearing when he was brought here. And I found four black hairs, all about 2 inches long. One on his shirt, one on his trousers, and two on his thermal underwear. I taped them to the fabric where I found them."
I nodded noncommittally. The less I said, the more Dr. Gleason thought she needed to explain to us. And she continued,
"These were not the deceased's hair. In fact, these hairs, under magnification, did not look human."
Kate asked,
"Dog hairs?
Maybe."
Kaiser Wilhelm? Dr. Gleason concluded, "That's all that I found on the body that might be unusual." Kate asked her, "Can you estimate the time of death?" "Based on what I see, feel, and smell, I believe death occurred about 24 hours ago, maybe less." She added, "The CSI team might find something that could narrow it down, and so might the medical examiner who does the autopsy." I asked, "Did you remove the clothing and personal effects?"
"I did, with an assistant."
"Other than the animal hair and foreign fibers, did you notice anything else unusual?"
"Such as?"
"Well, unusual."
"No, but if you sniff his clothes, especially his shirt, you might still detect a faint odor of smoke."